then as we moved into the early 2000s through today, we had a ton of innovation. We had what those technologies, what those low-level protocol-level technologies allowed was a growth of the application layer. So we had applications and networks like Facebook and YouTube and Instagram all pop up and create this connected network that we have. It allowed for massive explosion in global e-commerce. It connected individuals and created relationships across the world, and for a lot of people improved the quality of life that they were experiencing and are experiencing today. At the same time, the internet started with such grand purpose, but quickly kind of shifted to this model that's so profit-driven and really created these monopolistic organizations that are so focused on kind of squeezing the money out of the data that they're collecting on you and I.
This time on the Plutopia News Network, we present a rebroadcast of a recent EFF Austin live stream. Dan Reeser, Community and Growth Manager for Polkadot, a next-generation blockchain network, presents a vision for Web 3.0, a movement seeking to return control, privacy, and power to the individual internet user. Special thanks to Kevin Welch and EFF Austin for sharing this content.
Welcome, everyone, to the first ever virtual EFF Austin meetup. We've been doing these in the flesh for many years, but as befits a digital civil liberties org, we are finally fully moving into cyberspace with this here. So thank you all for joining us. So our speaker this month is Dan Reeser. Dan is the Community and Growth Manager for Polkadot, a next-generation blockchain network founded by the former co-founder and CTO of Ethereum, Gavin Wood. For probably most people in this room know, Ethereum is probably the most prominent cryptocurrency after Bitcoin. Polkadot will begin its phase launch process in second quarter 2020. I don't know if that timetable is still accurate. I'm sure Dan can tell you more, but that was the original plan, aiming to solve many of the current issues hindering blockchains from adoption at a global scale, including connection between blockchains, scalability, and rapid upgradability. Dan graduated with a bachelor and master's degree from Indiana University's Kelley School of Business and Information Systems and International Business. He's had a marketing and operations-focused career with 4 years at Eli Lilly and Company, working in pharmaceutical brand marketing and oncology. So Dan transitioned his career to blockchain out of a curiosity for the technology's potential, which led him to Austin for his first job with another blockchain project called WanChain. He led marketing and business development globally for this organization before opting to join Polkadot's historic launch under the Web 3.0 Foundation based in Switzerland. He lives in Austin as an avid traveler and as a competitive tennis player. So Dan is going to be talking with us about Web 3.0. For those of us who've been around on the internet long enough, we remember back in the mid-2000s, there was a big deal made about Web 2.0, where the whole idea was that websites would no longer be static HTML pages with creator-generated content. Instead, they would be based around dynamic APIs that allowed for user-generated content. Everybody was very excited about the possibilities this represented at the time, but as the last 15 years of web history has shown us, opening up all these APIs and allowing for user-generated content and graph scraping and sharing and transformation of these data sets has led to many of the current problems both the web and the world is facing. So you may be like, well, what is Web 3.0? What is the next phase or step for the web? And, I could tell you what little I know all about it, but that's why we have Dan here to tell you more about it. So without further ado, Dan, I'd say feel free to go ahead and get started and present your presentation, and hopefully you'll be able to do it relatively technical, difficulty-free.
So I'm going to dive into Web 1.0 first, just to set some context as far as where we're headed, where we are now, and where we're headed with Web 3.0. So obviously the internet started back in the 60s and 70s, but around 1990 is when we started to see, kind of like Kevin just touched on, a read-only internet where certain technologies came about, like you see at the bottom, like TCP, SMTP for email, internet browsers, but this was a kind of a basic internet that was read-only, meaning that most people, like consumers, parents, grandparents type of technological capability, were only able to consume what was on the internet and not necessarily write information in to the internet as it stood. I included these technologies here at the bottom for a specific purpose. I'll revisit these towards the end and make a comparison to kind of what we're building in Web 3.0 right now and how that's similar to what this technology at this phase of the internet allowed. At this point, you had a lot of networks that were operating in silos, like the early internet networks in the United States. Eventually, these networks were connected through these technologies and then obviously eventually grew into this global internet that we have today. So these low-level protocol type technologies are one to remember towards the end of the presentation. Then as we moved into the early 2000s through today, we had a ton of innovation. We had what those technologies, what those low-level protocol-level technologies allowed was a growth of the application layer. So we had applications and networks like Facebook and YouTube and Instagram all pop up and create this connected network that we have. It allowed for massive explosion in global e-commerce. It connected individuals and created relationships across the world, and for a lot of people, improved the quality of life that they were experiencing and are experiencing today. At the same time, the internet started with such grand purpose, but quickly kind of shifted to this model that's so profit-driven and really created these monopolistic organizations that are so focused on kind of squeezing the money out of the data that they're collecting on you and I. So this has brought us to, and I know I'm preaching to the choir here about privacy, but this brought us to kind of where we are today. The time after time, data breaches or privacy concerns, and I'll bring up a few more examples of that in a second, just to highlight the need for organizations like EFF and for technologies like Web 3.0 companies are building right now to shift the power back away from these monopolies back to kind of the individuals. Another important piece to bring up, as Kevin mentioned, the election coming up this year, I've actually been keeping a note in my iPhone of every time I see an ad. So if it's on Instagram, if it's on TV, but just trying to make myself aware of the technology that of the advertising that I'm seeing through the technologies that I consume. But it's just something to keep in mind when you think back at 2016 and what happened with Cambridge Analytica. And it's just something to be aware of, I think, for all of us heading into this election year. And then last, the internet started, like I mentioned before, all this amazing e-commerce capability. But what we've seen recently is that the new model or the current model of the internet has shifted to turn us as the consumers into the product. So when you see, like when I saw Spotify, for example, offering me a free Google Home, why are they offering me a free Google Home, which retails for, I think, around $100? Because my data, my Spotify data for them to associate with my Google record is way more valuable than the $100 piece of hardware that they want to, put into my home. So this original tech boom that everyone was so excited about in the early 2000s, late 90s, has really shifted to become an advertising and marketing boom. And hopefully new technologies and regulations will help us get away from this new model. So a lot of people are asking where our privacy has gone. And I know everyone here is aware of Edward Snowden and kind of the courage and bravery that he had in 2013 to come out based on his experience at the NSA. Another great example, the New York Times Privacy Project. If you're not aware of that journalistic work that the New York Times is doing, they're doing an excellent job in the privacy space. So it's definitely worth following them and reading some of the articles that they've come out with. But this is just one example of of real world data that they got on cell phones within New York City. And it's just incredible to see, you know, how they were able to track certain, you know, famous individuals, certain congressional members, and so on, throughout DC and New York, through data that they were able to collect through, you know, cell phone companies. Cambridge Analytica, just again, I mentioned them earlier, but just to highlight the breadth, the global breadth of influence that they had prior to really being exposed after the 2016 election. This is a real slide from a pitch deck that Cambridge Analytica gave, and they literally call it persuasion digital marketing. So people may or may not agree, but I would venture to guess that although Cambridge Analytica may not be the one doing it, I'm fairly positive that money has just shifted somewhere else. This is such a powerful tool that politicians have at their hands now. So I think we'd all be crazy to think that this isn't going on somewhere in the world, just without people knowing at this point. And then this is actually something that came up around, what was it, 4 or 5, 6 days ago. I actually don't remember the date. but Congress was pressuring Jared Kushner recently, within the past week, on this health data surveillance that he's doing. And if you can see here on the right, here's the actual letter that was written to Kushner, talking about the serious concerns they have with the secrecy of the efforts that he was going about with big tech companies to create this kind of behind the scenes group of tech companies to collect and analyze healthcare data. Yes, with the purpose of helping COVID-19, but what regulation, who is watching over the data that they're collecting and making sure that they're not using that data for other purposes, for building up their database after the COVID-19 pandemic has passed. So just the wording here I thought was just very powerful, like the impact on the health privacy of Americans, and talking about how this only compounds the concerns they have with the lack of transparency with this initiative that he's working on. Coming from the healthcare space, I'm also really interested in kind of like the digital healthcare apps, the telehealth apps. And this article also mentioned that these telehealth apps right now are clearly on the rise, but a lot of these apps, actually most of these apps actually don't fall under the HIPAA regulations that like a normal doctor's office or anything of that nature would fall under. So we're also now seeing a lot of these healthcare applications collecting data and then having the ability without HIPAA restrictions to then sell that data on to another third-party data purchaser. So just another thing, very, very recent to keep in mind when we're thinking about our data privacy, and especially for, you know, people like in my friends and family who say that they don't necessarily care about companies like Apple or Google having our data. It starts to get really personal when you start thinking about people knowing your healthcare data, your blood pressure, your sleep habits, and so on. And then last, you may have heard about this in Kentucky, somebody who refused to stay home and the judge actually ordered them to wear an ankle bracelet like they were on house arrest. So that's where it starts to really cross the line and make you a little bit worried and knowing that we need to start making changes. So given all that background, where do we go from here and what solutions are there to these privacy issues? So one, I'm sure this is a crowd that is very aware of end-to-end encryption. Signal, obviously, being the best messaging app for this purpose. Riot Chat is actually something that you may not be aware of. My entire company, the Web3 Foundation, actually operates on Riot, and the Matrix protocol is actually an end-to-end encrypted, an end-to-end encrypted open source technology that can be used by individuals, by organizations, and even by governments, like we've seen in France. And then last, HTTPS encryption has really reached, I think, 90-95% adoption. So that's another good progression in that regard. On the regulation front, I won't spend too much time on this, but We've seen a lot of great progress with 3DPR, the California Consumer Privacy Act, and then the facial recognition bans that we've started to see in places that are, you know, more on the progressive end of things, like San Francisco and Boston and cities like this around the United States. And last, and these are just three examples of solutions, but the last example of a solution for restoring privacy is, of course, the kind of the main topic of this presentation, which is decentralization and moving towards trustless technology. And I'll get into these concepts here in a second. So here we are in the year 2020, and we are starting to see the beginnings of Web 3.0. And one thing to keep in mind, the blockchain is definitely not the only component of Web 3.0. These four here are examples. AR, VR, artificial intelligence has massive potential. Internet of Things has already been growing and will continue to grow. And then blockchain and cryptocurrency will play a major role, especially at the foundational level, in what Web 3.0 will become down the road. Web 3.0, you may hear referred to as a semantic web. So humans and machines being able to interact based on logical reasoning and logical relationships instead of really just simplistic relationships with humans interacting with the internet or their computers. A user-centric web, so again, bringing kind of the power back into the hands of the individual, decentralizing and pulling away from these big monopolies. And then trustless, so getting away from these central authorities, these middlemen that we're having to trust our data, our money with, our information with, to not do something malicious with. So now I'll zero in on this kind of component of Web3. So Web 3.0 in a blockchain context, we're really talking about, like I mentioned, bringing power back to individuals, removing powerful central points of control. So when you hear the word decentralization, it's all about taking, all of Facebook's servers in San Francisco, or all of Google's servers in San Francisco, or all of Santander Bank's servers in, I believe they're in Madrid. Just getting away from this model where an individual company or an individual organization owns everything and can control, can alter and manipulate the data that they own. And then last, we have to remind ourselves that we are very lucky, especially at a time like this, where we're kind of being woken up to some realities that a lot of people in other parts of the world live with. We are lucky enough to, I think most of us on this call are lucky enough to earn US dollars, to live and save and earn US dollars. And we have access because of that to the banking system. We have access to the equities market. We have access to a lot of financial, financial freedoms and benefits that a lot of people in other parts of the world, South America, Africa, Southeast Asia, you name it, there's so many people who don't have the luxuries that we do and don't have access to banks. So part of one of the interesting use cases of blockchain is being able to bring this financial participation to individuals who may not be able to do so using the current system. So I'm going to try to go somewhat slow here and just explain the best I can what blockchain is as a whole. Many of you may have heard and know what blockchain is, so I apologize, but for those who may not be as familiar, I'll do my best to explain kind of the basic idea of what blockchain or what a blockchain is, give a couple kind of analogies and examples, and then hopefully you can ask questions at the end if it's not quite clear, but it's fairly complicated, trying to simplify. So a blockchain at its core is a digital chain made up of blocks of information hosted on a decentralized and distributed network of computers that cannot be altered or changed. So this is illustrating a centralized point of control. So if there's information on this network, for example, It can be changed. It can be altered by whoever owns it. This is illustrating a distributed network, a decentralized network, where there's not one point of failure. There's not one point of manipulation. And the network is spread amongst a group of people or a group of organizations, and even geographically dispersed. And I'll explain more of this in an example next. And then this is blocked by this Google thing, but it says blocks are chunks of data. Sorry, I can't read this. Basically saying blocks
are... If you click hide, you can hide
there. There we go. Thank you. So blocks are chunks of data collected over a specific period of time. So let me get into this in just 1 second. Here's an analogy that was explained to me once and really kind of made sense as far as what this blockchain is, what this ledger is. So a blockchain is very similar to this concept where imagine yourself at a poker table or imagine just watching these people play poker. After every hand, everyone records the results of each hand in their own notebook on the side. So they're keeping tallies of who has how many chips. After the full game is complete, all the players agree on the chip counts and they finalize that game. So after game one, they all compare their notes and they say, yep, you're right. Let's consider that a block. So that period of time was one game, and that block has been agreed upon by all eight players, and finalized as a block and added to this hypothetical blockchain. They play two more games, and after the second game, they also took notes and agreed upon the results. After the third game, they did the same. And now after the third game, they've all agreed three times. They've created three blocks of information based on those three games. But now one of the players, Kelly, is trying to cash out, and she's claiming that she has $100 more than she is actually owed. So here's the benefit of using a blockchain or using a ledger of information from the past that was agreed upon by multiple people. So everyone goes back and checks the records from the three previous games that were finalized and agreed upon by the group. Kelly's request is declined by the network. It's declined by the seven other people because she didn't actually earn $100 more than that. She was then paid what she is truly owed. So hopefully that explains kind of how this ledger works and how the network, imagine these being servers and having to agree upon a specific, a specific unit of information in a specific period of time. So sorry for the busy slide here. Here's just like a little bit more of a real example of a blockchain example, very basic, but these are now, I'm giving it a date. So each block is one day. So you have April 12th. It shows the account balances. It shows what happened during that period. And then it shows the end account. And of course, the end moves up here. So now here's April 13th. This block was finalized. This information was kind of agreed upon by the network and set in stone after this day. Then we came over here. More action took place, finalized. Then we came to the 14th. Everything happened, finalized, and then the 15th. So we ended with me having 500K, Kevin having zero, and Bill having 4.5 million. So here's those four blocks. And these 4 days of information or transactions have all been added to the chain of blocks, creating a blockchain. And this blockchain could technically be hosted on a centralized server like Facebook or Google or any Fortune 500 company today. They own their servers and they own all the information. But these, if you can see these colors here, this blockchain is also, in this case, let's say it's added to this decentralized network. So just like the poker table, these are all the poker players. They all know exactly what happened in the pink block, in the blue block, in the orange block, and the teal block. And they all have agreed upon what happened in the past and what happened in the blocks preceding each specific block. So think back to this centralized server. Now let's imagine let's imagine Bill owns this server and he wants to be paid 500K more. So what's stopping him from going into the record, deleting this transaction, updating it to say that I paid him $1 million, and then he runs away with his $5 million? It's really no different than the exposure to hackers that we've seen with organizations like Equifax. It's no different than some of the accounting scandals that we've seen in the past, because when people own the database, they own the data, they can do whatever they want with it. Now, here is a kind of a visual, and apologies if this is fairly technical, but this is kind of how a blockchain network looks today. Like, this is what Ethereum looks like today, but way more servers, way more global breadth. But imagine the same blockchain that was on this server that was able to be edited by Bill. This is a situation where it's nearly impossible to alter a record, because if this server, say whoever is running the server in, it looks like Russia, say they want to change the data of this blue block, the second block from April 15th. All these other networks, all these other servers, all these other poker players from our example would all immediately say, no, that's not true, because that's not what we agreed upon at the end of that block. So that, that change to that record would be declined and the network would go on with their business. Hopefully somewhat complicated, but for those of you who are new to blockchain, hopefully you can kind of understand, like, even just what the name blockchain means. It's literally a chain of blocks of information. But just like these examples on the previous slides were talking about, the one example was talking about kind of like a financial information, but financial data on the blockchain can be the same as, drug supply chain information or identity. So in this case with identity, this is a very interesting topic that a lot of these blockchain organizations are working on, which is the concept of you owning your own identity in some kind of a digital wallet. So instead of it blows my mind that I still have to worry about a piece of paper for me to get out of like Germany to get back to the US. If I lose my passport, I'm screwed and I have to go to the American consulate or whatever to get my new passport to get home. But imagine hopefully in the next 10 years, I have my passport in my encrypted digital wallet on my phone. I own the private key or I own the password to that, and only I can get in that. And I can choose who I give my identity to. So maybe I'll scan my thumb and give my ID to TSA when I get back to Washington, D.C., but I have control over when I own it or when I give my identity up to someone. Anonymous logins is another interesting concept, especially with regards to privacy. So if you think about every time you sign up for a new, any service on the internet that has these buttons to make it easy, easy login with Facebook, easy login with Google, they're probably collecting God knows how many pictures and birthdays and friends that I have on Facebook just to make it seem easy to the user when I log in. We're also seeing a lot of people, even at my organization, working on what they call like Web3 logins or pseudo-anonymous or anonymous logins to allow us to take part in some of these services or marketplaces without having to give up so much of our identity or our data. And then last, this is another thing that just blows my mind. I was in Brazil trying to go to a meetup in Colombia, and I didn't have a yellow fever immunization form to show the Brazilian airline. So I wasn't allowed to fly to Colombia. I had to cancel my trip and fly back to the US. I started thinking, like, I wouldn't even know where to begin finding my immunizations records after living in, Northern Indiana, going to college in a different city, living in Indianapolis, moving to Austin, Texas. Like, when did I get that? it's I don't know where to even begin, but it's we need to get to the point where, just like with the digital identity, we all will own our healthcare data in some kind of an encrypted digital application, call it a wallet, where I own all of my previous records from doctor's visits, I own immunization records, and I can choose to give my healthcare data to a dentist, or I can choose to give my healthcare data to a physician, or whatever the use case is. So these are just four examples of different use cases among many, many different use cases, but just a few that I thought would make some sense to this group. So brief kind of history here of blockchain, and something that's pretty interesting to keep in mind is that a lot of people, including myself before I really got deep into this industry, think that Bitcoin was just kind of this magical thing that sprouted up in 2009. But in reality, this actually dates back to this guy, David Chaum. He's a kind of a legend in the industry, still working on a project now, but came up with this concept of digital cash back in the early 80s. This concept continued to evolve into hash cash in 1997. And these are all things that you can Google, and they're pretty interesting to read the history on. But Hashcash was kind of like the first version of Bitcoin almost, because Bitcoin has this hashing capability that is very technical, but you can also Google that later. And then Bitcoin came around in 2009, which is very interesting timing, just following the financial crisis in 2008. And that led on to 2015. So 2014 or 2015 is when Ethereum started getting built. Bitcoin at this point was really just a peer-to-peer kind of payment mechanism. What Ethereum did was it added what's called smart contracts. So it's basically the ability to program something or add. It's basically adding programmability to on top of kind of this payment layer. So now you're seeing on Ethereum a lot of what they call dApps, a decentralized application for so many use cases, including identity, like I mentioned. But probably the biggest area on Ethereum right now of growth is what they're calling decentralized finance, or DeFi. So that's kind of where Ethereum is today. Going back to 2015, when Ethereum launched, like Kevin mentioned in the intro, Gavin Wood was one of the original co-founders. He invented the Solidity programming language, is actually used to build on Ethereum. He left at that time and dedicated all of his time and focus on building this project called Polkadot. So it's been, the name and the project has been around for quite some time, around 2 or 3 years, and has really been kind of under wraps. The whole team has been heads down focused on building this. But the reason I'm working on this project and the reason I'm here is really because I'm pretty confident this is the third, major innovation in this industry. And part of the goal today, I'm definitely not going to go super deep in Polkadot because it's very complex technologically. But the goal here is just to kind of give you the awareness that Polkadot's coming. Just keep your eye out for it. It's really interesting what Polkadot is doing and what I think it's going to enable in terms of blockchain adoption and the ability to actually scale and handle transactions to the level of like a Visa or one of these organizations today. So this is a very busy slide, but really meant to show you how many aspects there are to Web3. Like I mentioned before, the smart contracts on Ethereum is really what kind of sparked this next step in the history of this industry. This is basically the way this is set up, is going from the base layer protocol. And when protocol is a pretty technical word, but you can think back to like TCP/IP in the early internet when I was mentioning that. And as you head up, this is like the application layer, the browser layer. So here's Brave browser, which many of you probably have heard of. And this is really where we'll start to see applications, and hopefully soon, applications that can be used by normal everyday users. In my opinion, people should never even know that there's a blockchain behind it. If they do know, it's probably a problem because it's probably not a great user experience. So this is, you know, a lot of the work and innovation that's being done today in Web3. And this is actually built by Multicoin Capital, which is based in Austin, which is pretty cool. So the history going from Bitcoin to Ethereum to now, before Polkadot is launched, this is currently the way the blockchain ecosystem is operating. Everything that's being done on Bitcoin is separate from everything being done on Ethereum, which is also separate from everything being done on Tezos, which is another blockchain platform. If you think back to this map, this is the same thing as the US not being able to communicate with Sao Paulo, or Australia operating on this island with no connection to anything else on Earth. And same with every other continent. This is how the blockchain organization is operating today. And a big reason why you haven't seen like full mainstream adoption of blockchain and all the promise that it has. So this is why I was mentioning this part of the slide earlier. These technologies helped connect internet networks of the 90s. So you had these low-level like protocol layer technologies that I couldn't even come close to understanding how they actually work, but what they enabled was this application layer of Facebook, of Chrome, of YouTube, because we had the connectivity of networks across the world. We're seeing the exact same thing now. That's what Polkadot is building. It's the equivalent to this low-level protocol connectivity that we saw here. We're building consensus mechanisms. We're building what's called cross-chain message passing. We're building bridges to existing networks, which all this stuff is not going to be consumer-facing. But then this is where the really exciting and fun part comes. So we've got a company based out of the Ukraine building what's called Subsocial. So this is a platform for building social networks that aren't owned by any one entity. They're decentralized social networks. So it's the beginnings of a decentralized Facebook. There's another one, Akala, based out of New Zealand, and they're building a very, very exciting and interesting platform for decentralized finance, for everything from synthetic asset trading to margin trading on crypto and on traditional assets, but again, all in a decentralized manner. And then Brave, of course, just wanted to include that because it's such a well-known name and they are already doing great work in the Web3 space. So here's we have an amazing designer at Polkadot. So Iggy made this just to kind of represent what Polkadot is. So I won't get into the specifics. I can either send a prior presentation if people are interested in how Polkadot works at the technology level. But essentially these little squares are all blockchains. So this one square here is the equivalent to Ethereum. This one is equivalent to Tezos. So we're going to have a huge network of connected blockchains that will all interact, with information, with data, with value. And this will allow applications built on custom blockchains to interact with one another and interact with legacy networks like Ethereum and Bitcoin, Tezos, and then Hyperledger being kind of a enterprise or private blockchain focused or consortium blockchain. This is getting into the weeds a little bit, but just to explain kind of why I and a lot of people are so excited about what's coming with Polkadot, just because it's finally connecting everything together at the basic notion. So to kind of start wrapping things up, we're obviously here in the year 2020, and Web3 and Web2 are both going on at the same time. So the people at the Web3 Foundation, the people that are building these technologies, they have a lot of choices now with where we take this. So one thing, I was just listening to a podcast yesterday called Relay Chain, and they had a really interesting topic around making sure that we build Web3 and keep users in mind and keep the principles of what we're trying to achieve in mind, because it's very easy to quickly veer towards the way Web 2 went and forget about what it's all about. So that's why I add here, we must build with the users and Web 3 principles first and protect against, a re-aggregation of power. The same thing that happened with Web 2 at the application layer, at the company layer, when things started shifting into the hands of these big monopolies. This is kind of similar to what I already mentioned before, but just to reiterate that blockchain in general it's going to take some time. Polkadot, like I mentioned, is a protocol layer. It's kind of the base layer that all these incredibly smart developers are building on top of. So when you think about how does Polkadot's decentralized or blockchain technology help privacy? It's more so that we're building these building blocks for developers who are going to build these applications on top. The developers can leverage all the benefits of blockchain, including the trustlessness, the immutability, and the security of blockchain, and hopefully set them up to be able to build things that will change the world for the better.
Learn more about Polkadot and Web 3.0 at polkadot.network. EFF Austin meets on the second Tuesday of each month, currently via WebEx conference. Learn more at EFFAustin.org. You can stay in touch with Plutopia at plutopia.io. On Facebook, look for @PlutopiaNews. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. With John Lubkowski, I'm Scoop Sweeney. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.